As you're getting yourself situated, I'll give you a moment to put the songbook away and then to get out your Bibles. And when you get your Bibles in your hand, if you will, open up to Matthew, the 24th chapter. And in just a moment, we're going to start our reading in that particular chapter. What I would like for you to do in the very beginning is for a moment just forget about everything that has happened today. Forget for a moment about politics and about sports and about your job. And use your mind to go backwards in time. To go back to the first century. It has been announced that this lesson tonight is entitled, "This World is Not My Home." And if we can look at some folks in the first century and look at what their attitude was, then maybe it will help us have a good attitude in the 21st century. Now, this photograph is a model of what that some folks believe that the temple looked like in the first century. If you're able to visit Jerusalem, you can go out in the backyard of King David Hotel, and you can walk around the model of the city of Jerusalem, and you can photograph this temple like this and look at all of the other buildings. Now, in Matthew chapter 24, we find that the apostles were very, very impressed with this building. And they wanted to brag about that building, as maybe sometimes some of us have a tendency of wanting to brag about some building that might be in our town. And in Matthew chapter 24, at verse 1, it says, "Jesus went out and departed from the temple. And his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple." Now, let's just stop the reading for just a moment and then look at the photograph. If we look at the delicacy of what that folks believed that it was like in the first century, and we look at the walls and we look at the ornateness, and so here they are saying, "Oh, isn't this beautiful? Isn't this impressive?" Now notice what Jesus says. "Jesus said unto them, See you not all of these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." And so when we look at what it might have possibly looked like and see how beautiful it could have been in the first century, and then we read these words of Jesus when he said there's not going to be one stone left on top of another stone. And those of you that enjoy studying world history, you recall that the Roman soldiers invaded Jerusalem in the year 70 AD and they burned the city of Jerusalem. They ransacked all of the buildings, the beautiful temple, the walls, all of the other things around that town were destroyed. A few years ago when I was touring in Jerusalem, I had a tour guide that wanted to take the group of Christians that I had taken over with me and wanted to take us up into a room and said, "Now, we want to show you the upper room where that Jesus met with his disciples when he instituted the Lord's Supper." And I raised my hand. I said, "Excuse me." I said, "Wasn't Jerusalem destroyed in 70? It's about like when you go to Rome and you visit a couple of the Catholic churches there. There's one of them that I went to and they wanted to show me the skull of Peter. That afternoon, I went to a different Catholic church, St. Lucas, and they wanted to show me the skull of Peter. And I said, "Excuse me." I said, "This morning, over at the other place across town, they showed me the skull of Peter." They said, "Well, that's when he was a teenager." It's amazing what they try to do for tourists. But you see, the city was destroyed. And so when we look at how all of that happened, according to the prophecy of Jesus, just try to imagine you're being told your world as you know it is going to be destroyed. Nashville, Tennessee is not going to exist. The big buildings that we are impressed with, all of the hotels, Opryland's going to be gone. All the downtown hotels are going to be gone. The convention center is going to be gone. The Titan Stadium is going to be gone. The city as you know it, your world as you know it, it's all going to be gone. Just imagine being told that. That's exactly what is happening here in Matthew 24. All right, now let's fast forward. A few years ago, Dolores, my wife that's with me here tonight, and our children went to New York City to do a little family vacation. And we took the little boat ride down the Hudson River. And now this photograph is made from the New Jersey side, looking back across to the New York side. Now I have a good friend that some of you may know, Gardner Hall. He's the son of Sewell Hall. And Gardner lives in New Jersey, but he preaches in New York City. He works among what many of us would call a lot of the street people. He works among the Spanish speaking. Some of these teenagers that he works with, I mean, they have already witnessed murders. One of the young girls says that her mother has been a prostitute. Some of them have been drug addicts and some very bad past lifestyles. But one day, Gardner had all these teenagers on an outing, and he brought them over to this very spot. And he said, now, I want you to look across, and I want you to stand here for a moment and just look at New York City. Now, I want you to close your eyes. And I want you to use your imagination. And I want you to tell me what you see 25 years from now. Well, one of the little girls with her eyes closed, she said, I see skyscrapers getting taller and taller and taller and taller. One of the young men with his eyes closed, he said, I just see the buildings getting more and more crowded as it's pressing in every direction and running out of land as New York is building. And the next young boy with his eyes closed said, I see nothing. Well, a few of the young people laughed, thinking he was telling a joke, you know, his eyes are closed, and so he says he sees nothing. And he said, no, I understand what the instructions were. You ask, what did I see 25 years from now? I see nothing. We lost the war. The terrorists have won. New York City, as we know it today, doesn't exist. Now that may sound rather morbid to us, but it could possibly be a realistic prediction. On September 11, 2001, at 7:30 a.m., this is what New York City looked like. About an hour and 10 minutes later, this is what New York City looked like. And many of you stayed glued to your TVs. You watched all of that. You kept up with everything that was happening. The greatest disaster in the United States. More deaths. And so if something like that is going to happen again, how are we going to cope with it? What's going to happen? How did the first century disciples, when they knew that their city was going to be destroyed, how did they cope with it? In Luke chapter 21 at verse 28, it says, now when these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads because your redemption draws near. Now how could early Christians be so accepting of the destruction around them? To say the city where I have always lived, the house that I have resided in, the shops where I used to do my shopping, everything that I have always known, it's not going to exist anymore. Now how could they handle that? And I think the answer is because they were of another world. I wonder how many times, since all of us have been Christians, I wonder how many times we have sung the song that we sang just before I walked up here, this world is not my home, I'm just passing through. Maybe we sing that song often, but do we really understand? Has it really sunk in? Now, in a couple of more weeks, I'm supposed to be getting on the airplane over here at the airport and flying from here to the Netherlands and from there to South Africa and then traveling into Zimbabwe. And you know, they won't allow me to get on the airplane in Nashville without showing them my passport. Because, see, I'm going to leave the soil of the United States and I'm going to another country. And so they're wanting some proof that I'm a citizen of the United States of America. And so I very proudly carry that little blue book with me and says, here's my photograph, here's my passport. But you know, there have been times that I don't want to be mean and I don't want to be ugly, but there have been times as I'm standing there at the counter and they're checking my plane ticket and they're asking to see my passport, that I just wanted to get into a real big religious discussion with them and say, well, I'm not a citizen of America. Of course, I don't get in that kind of an argument because they wouldn't let me on the airplane. But I'm trying to remind myself that I am a citizen of heaven. Now, I've always told people, be it my religion, be it my politics, or be it what kind of ice cream I like to eat, don't ask me my opinion if you don't want me to tell you. And so I get involved in politics. But regardless of who wins any election, whether it's our city mayor, whether it's our school board, whether it's our president, whether it's in Congress, regardless of who wins, my citizenship is not on the earth. My citizenship is in heaven. Now, sometimes electing the wrong people on our school board can make it harder for us. Electing the wrong people in city government can make it harder for us. Electing the wrong people for national campaigns could make it harder for us. When I was preaching in Indiana, I debated a lawyer, a woman that was active in the National Organization of Women. And she was trying to, at that time, get the Equal Rights Amendment passed. And she stated in her debate with me on the television, she said, if I can get this a law, she said, it will be illegal for you folks at the Church of Christ to meet. She said, I'm going to push the law that you'll have women preachers and you'll have women deacons and you'll have women elders. And some of you may have been on vacation when Yellowstone National Park tried that stupid thing they did. They took down the signs, ladies and gentlemen, restroom. And everybody just share one. Now you see, there are certain laws that will affect us. I was holding a gospel meeting up in Vermont. And on the marquee out in front of the building, like what you have right here, we just asked a series of questions. What does the Bible say about drunkenness? What does the Bible say about homosexuality? What does the Bible say about abortion? And I forget the rest of the list, but we got a knock on the door and there stood a policeman and he said, that sign has to be removed. We just had a city council meeting. And they passed a city law. I mean, we weren't stating what position we were holding. We were just asking questions. So you see, government can affect what happens sometimes in our schools, in our cities, and in our country. And so I do get involved, but even though I get involved, and I may vote in one direction and think that God's voted against me, but I do what I believe to be best at the time, but I keep reminding myself, I am not of this world. That's what Paul is saying in Philippians chapter 3 and in verse 20. Our citizenship is in heaven. I wish I could take a bunch of you with me in December when I go to China. It would be an awakening for some of you. That's a communist country. I've got a good friend in China that spent 20 years in prison only because he would not deny God.
They put him in prison, and there were times that the soldiers would come in and playing games with him. They would strip off his shirt, they would take their belts, and they would beat him. And one day they turned the belt around and used the metal buckles, beating him with the metal buckle, and one of the metal buckles hit him in the left eye and blinded him. They would go for days seeing what would happen to a human body if you tried to dehydrate him. And so they withheld his water. His lips were cracking, his tongue was swelling, his mouth was bleeding, and the soldiers would stand there with a pitcher of water and just pour it on the floor. And said, "I'll give you something to drink if you'll deny God." And Abraham said, "I will die in this prison before I will deny my God." When I go to China, I usually get a hotel room that's got two beds. And we push the two beds together in that room, and when we're having our Bible classes and our worship, everybody climbs up on top of the beds. Now, if you're wanting your private space, you're not going to want to go with me to China. Because you can't have your private space. Can you imagine as everybody's piled up on the bed and say, "Okay, it's time for us to begin our worship. Let's sing now." And you got to get your heads in real close together. Let's start singing. "Jesus loves me, this I know." That's as loud as we can sing. Because we're afraid if somebody hears us, they'll call the soldiers and then the students will be arrested. I've had Christian after Christian throughout China that said, one time I'd love to go to America. And one time I'd love to sit there in a building where that you've got 25 or 50 or 100 Christians and you get to sing as loud as you want to sing. And one of the things that's the hardest for me to answer, I had a young man a few years ago that said, "Bob, I read a book one time that says it must not be true. I need to ask you. You tell me whether or not this really happens in America." Said, "This book says that there are some churches in America that have a Sunday morning worship hour and then they have a Sunday night worship hour, and there's a lot of the people that go on Sunday morning that don't go back on Sunday night." They said, "Surely that's not true. I mean, we would so love to be able to attend Bible classes and hours of worship and sing with people and pray with people and study with people. Tell me, in a free country where that you're not going to be arrested and you're not going to be persecuted, tell me that doesn't happen." What would you say to them? I had breakfast with a young girl that was just about 2 months short of graduation from college. She was called before her dean. She said, "I'm going to ask you a question, and all I want is just yes or no. I don't want any commentary. It has been reported that you're a believer in Jesus Christ now. Is that true?" And when she said yes, he grabbed a big rubber stamp and stamped it across her transcript. She was kicked out of college. Her transcript will never be allowed to be transferred to any other university or college. She will never be able to graduate. All because she believed in God. I have story after story of college students that have become Christians and then been disowned by their parents. To be evicted from their apartments. Doc, a Christian in Vietnam, was engaged to be married. And then his fiance said to him, "You're going to have to choose. It's either me or your God. You can't have both." He loved that girl, but he stood with his God, and they called off that marriage. When I'm in poor countries like Ghana, like Zimbabwe, like Mozambique,
When I'm in some of these back jungle areas and they don't have food for their stomachs, and many of you have been asking me a lot of questions after you saw the pictures yesterday. And today there's been a flood of emails that came in. Over the weekend, two more Christians died. They're starving to death. And so many times they tell me, Bob, if we stay in our huts, we stay in our houses, we have no food for our stomach. But you can give us food for our soul. Preach on. Heaven's going to be beautiful. There'll be no hunger in heaven. There'll be no persecution in heaven. And so I believe that they keep themselves focused, that they are citizens in heaven. Simon Peter gives us this warning in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11. He says, Beloved, I beg you. And then here's another phrase from where that we got one of our songs tonight. Sojourners and pilgrims. Now, in the original Greek language, this is a very strong word, as if that he is down on his knees in front of you. He says, I am begging you. I am begging you that you abstain from fleshly lust, of those things that war against the soul. Now you remember, it was this same writer that says that the devil is walking around like a lion looking for someone to have for lunch. Now, as I told you yesterday, when I'm in the bush in Zimbabwe, I try to get out of there before it's really pitch black. Because the lions sleep in the daytime and they wake up at nighttime and then they're ready to eat. And I don't want them to have me for dinner. And Simon Peter says, you need to understand, you're in a war. Now the Apostle Paul later uses a fancy word. He says that we're supposed to walk circumspectly. Now some of these girls were talking to me about their classes and all, and they probably could tell us in their math class what circumference means, and talking about what's on the outside there. And that's the same root word where we get that word to walk circumspectly. Now let me illustrate it for you. If I'm going out there at nighttime in the jungle and I hear the lion roaring, you know how I'm going to walk? It's going to be walking like this. I'm going to be looking all around. That's what that word circumspectly means. You see, that lion's out there after me. I don't want him to have me. And so that's what Paul is saying, and that's what Peter said. The devil is after you. You made a commitment one time in your life. You made a commitment to say, Jesus, I will follow you. Now the devil is trying to get you off the path. And the Bible emphasizes that the devil will offer a variety of temptations. That's why the Bible talks about fleeing youthful lust. When I read that, I understand that there are things that are temptations for young people that are not temptations for the middle age. But there are temptations for the middle age that are not temptations for the senior citizens. And there are temptations for the senior citizens that would not be temptations for some of the other people. You see, the devil is going to have a homemade temptation for every age. And if you resist one of them, the devil will take one step back, wait a few hours or a couple of days, and then take two steps forward, and the devil's after you again. And that's why Simon Peter says, I'm begging you. I'm begging you that you abstain from fleshly lust that war against the soul. Hebrews chapter 11 is what we often call the Hall of Fame of Faith. Someone has called that the Reader's Digest version of the Old Testament. Hebrews 11 lists a bunch of men and women, and they're listed here because of their strong faith. In verse 13, it says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them and embraced them, And they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Can you imagine when God told Abraham in Genesis 11 and 12, He says, leave your country. Leave the town that you're familiar with. Leave your families. Leave your friends. Leave the markets that you're accustomed to and go unto a new country. Can you imagine when God told Abraham when that he thought that he and his wife were beyond childbearing years? And to say that from you there is going to come a multitude of people, there's going to be a giant, giant kingdom that's going to come from you. When that God told Abraham about the land flowing with milk and honey, did Abraham ever see it? Not with his eyes, but by faith he saw it. Have you ever tried to close your eyes after reading a few chapters in the book of Revelation and try to imagine what streets of gold would be like? And try to imagine that throne with a lake in front of it that looks like it's glass, that's got a rainbow behind it? Have you ever tried to listen to the sounds as that great multitude is in front of the throne and they're singing, Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty? Have you ever tried to imagine what those beautiful gates would be like and those walls, the pearls and the sapphires and the jasper and the onyx? You see, with your eyes, you can't see heaven. But in faith, you can. And that's what this chapter is all about. You go on then into verses 15 and 16. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better country. That is a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared a city for them. Of all the countries on this earth, I'm convinced that heaven is that America is the best one on this earth. But I'm looking forward to a home far better than anything that anybody could ever have on this earth. I'm looking for a better home. Let me give you a couple of quotes before we close this lesson. Here's a quote from Justin Martyr. Now, these are non-biblical quotes, but showing you their spiritual interest. This was in the second century. And he said, since our thoughts are not fixed on the present, we're not concerned when men put us to death. An elder in the early second century said, brothers, let us willingly leave our sojourn in this present world so that we can do the will of Him who called us. And let us not fear to depart out of this world. Cyprian said, the one peaceful and trustworthy tranquility, the one security that is solid, that is firm, that is never changing is this. For a man to withdraw from the distractions of this world, to anchor himself to the firm ground of salvation, and to lift his eyes from earth to heaven. I wonder how it would change our lives spiritually if every time that we greeted each other and shook hands with each other, if we said, look up. Think about heaven. Dolores and I lived in Paris, Kentucky for 6 years. We helped establish the congregation there, and that is where that Barton Warren Stone did his preaching there. And he says, you must not mind earthly things nor set your affections on them, not to be conformed to the world. Here you have no abiding place, but are strangers and pilgrims seeking a better country. That was his quote in 1841.
If somebody was going to write your biography and quote you in 2008, what could they say about you? First and foremost, you're interested in heaven? That your number one goal is to be right with God? Why do you think it is so difficult to keep our mind on heaven? Why do you think it's so hard to be otherworldly? I think I can answer it with one word. And that is our prosperity. I have gone to countries like Sweden, and I've not been able to find one single Christian. I've been to Denmark, and I haven't found one single Christian. There are many of the European countries, as they become wealthier and wealthier and wealthier, they have less and less and less interest towards God, towards the Bible, towards anything that is spiritual. Drugs are permissible. Abortion is permissible. Illicit sex is permissible. Because they have no interest in anything other than this world. When I go to poor countries, third world countries, when I go to Kenya, when I go to Ghana, when I go to Vietnam, when I go to the Philippines, when I go to Zimbabwe, it seems that the poorer they are, the more interested they are in heaven, because things are so bad here, they're looking forward to a better land. But you see, we think we have accomplished a lot. Look what I did. I got my education, I got my job, I bought my car, I built my house, I chose the best stocks and bonds. Look what I did. Now here just a few days ago, there were a lot of people panicking. I mean, stock market hit the lowest that it had hit since the 30s. Are we going into another depression? Are we going to lose everything we've got? Are we going to lose our jobs? Are we going to lose our houses? Now, a lot of folks over in Japan committed suicide because they couldn't keep their mind focused on heaven. Is serving God and going to heaven the number one thing in our life? When I read Deuteronomy chapter 8, it almost reads like that God is writing it to modern America today. Before they were going to cross over into the promised land, He says, "Now beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping His commandments, His judgments, and His statutes, which I command you today." Okay, now before you cross the Jordan River, before you go over into that land of milk and honey, let's remember who God is. And let's remember who you're supposed to be, the people of God. And let's remember what God's laws are. And it goes on in verse 12, "Be real careful, lest when you have eaten and are full, when you have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, when your herds and your flocks multiply, when your silver and your gold are multiplied, when all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage." I wonder how many of us eat and get full. We get our paychecks on Friday and run to the bank. We remodel our houses and we buy new furniture. And we get tired of the last TV and the last computer and the Game Boy and the Xbox, and we want the newest and the latest. And we get so swept up with things. Now don't misunderstand me. I'm not opposed to any of those things that I just named.
as long as we keep them in perspective. I had a very good friend that was an elder in a church out in California. And people asked him, said, "Why are you building an 8-bedroom house? Your children are grown. It's just you and your wife." And he spent the next 15 years taking care of any widow lady that did not have children to take care of. He brought them into his home. He and his wife fed them and clothed them and cared for them when they were sick and buried them when they died. Now, some people might want to build a big house just so they'll be listed on the society page. Others have a dream of that big house. Well, I can adopt a few children. I can take care of some widow ladies. See, things are not wrong in and of themselves as long as we have our direction pointed towards heaven. Now, let me use one final chart here. And how do we know when that we're of this world? Now, I don't want everybody to pick up your songbooks and throw them at me at the same time. Stay with me as I try to reason with you on this. There are many churches that have become so involved in the social gospel, and I'm sure that you've seen a lot of those advertisements in the newspaper. I was holding a gospel meeting in Knoxville, and one of the churches down there advertised that they had a $100 bill taped on the top of a greased flagpole. And after worship, they were going to have a contest to see who could climb the greased flagpole and get the $100 bill. I hear of churches that's having ice cream suppers. They're having all kinds of basketball tournaments and baseball tournaments and softball tournaments and soccer tournaments. Pizza eating contest. Now you look around this building tonight, we've still got a few empty pews. But if we probably advertised that we were going to have a contest tonight to see who could eat the most Kentucky Fried Chicken, it's all free, we probably wouldn't have had an empty pew here tonight, would we? James Needham said years ago when he was preaching in Louisville, he said, "You know what? You could get a lot of new members if you promised them fried chicken, ice cream, and iced tea. But if that's what it's going to take to get them, you're going to have to use that to keep them. And what you're going to have will be a member about as dead as the chicken, about as cold as the ice cream, and about as weak as the tea." Now, I was impressed yesterday and again tonight when you look at these young people sitting up front here. I think it is an insult to the intelligence of these young people to say, "Well, we could offer you a Bible class, but we don't think you'd be impressed with that. We don't think you'd really be spiritual minded enough that you would want that." I think it insults you young people to say, "Well, you wouldn't want Bible, so we'll give you pizza instead." Eating pizza is not going to make you a stronger Christian. Studying the Bible will. Singing spiritual songs will. And so you can tell some of these churches out here in the community when they are of this world instead of another world, when that they are appealing to the social gospel. Now, this is the one that usually gets me in trouble. And that is our conversations before we start our worship and our conversation as immediately as we end our worship. Now, there again, don't misunderstand me, please. I'm not opposed for us talking about the baseball games. I'm not opposed to us talking about the football games. I'm not opposed to us talking about whatever your hobby is, whatever your sports might be, whatever your politics might be. I'm not opposed to talking about it. But if that's all we want to talk about. And have you ever met someone like that? I mean, you just almost hate to see them coming. "Oh no. We're going to have another 1-hour lecture on the Titans." Now you see, if the only thing that we're talking about are fun things and things of this world, there's something wrong. I was invited to speak in a gospel meeting in Alabama, and the elders want me to do classes each morning at 10 a.m. and then preaching again at night. And then we had two or three nights. We had later night classes after our normal gospel meeting. The church had gone through a few problems, and the elders were trying to pull the brethren back together and unite them and give them direction and give them goals. And so the elders just said, okay, stay scriptural, but try something different. And so there's a few times that week as I would shake hands with somebody, I wouldn't turn loose of the man's hand. And I say, how are you, George? Oh, I'm okay. I said, no, really, how are you? Oh, well, I had a small headache this morning, but I'm okay. No, no, George, how are you, really? And so I just held on to his hand until we quit talking about the physical. I said, George, how are you spiritually? And then he sort of dropped his head. And he said, I'm not as strong as I used to be. I've got problems. I've been mad at this brother and haven't talked to him. I haven't been reading my Bible like I used to. I haven't been praying like I used to. I wonder, when we end tonight, rather than talking about some of these things, our TV shows and our movies and our hobbies and our entertainment, I issued another challenge in a gospel meeting one time, and I said, I want you to promise me that every day you're going to talk to one Christian. Now, if you don't have a Christian in your neighborhood, if you don't work with a Christian, you're going to have to use the telephone. It doesn't have to be a long conversation. Just make a 1 minute phone call. Hey, Carol, tell me, what's your favorite Bible verse? Just call somebody up. Say, hey, what's your favorite religious song? What's your favorite Old Testament Bible story? You see, if we just help each other stay focused, we're not of this world. I'm sure the elders could tell you about some congregations they've heard of. The preachers here could tell you about churches they've heard of, where that there are some places that want more of a light Bible study. We don't want too many scriptures. I looked at a workbook that was designed for our young people, and it said, read Genesis chapter 1 and count how many times the word thee is used. I haven't figured out yet how that's going to help me be any more spiritual. I mean, there's some Bible classes that are studying books about the Bible and not studying the Bible. On numerous occasions, I have had the good opportunity to work with young men in our preacher training programs. And that's what I've always tried to emphasize to them. You cannot preach well what you do not know well, and you cannot know well what you do not study well. Don't just dismiss and say, oh well, that worked 40 years ago, but we don't need that much Bible in our Bible classes tonight. Maybe you've heard about that set of videos that they've got out now. Churches are now watching the Andy Griffith Show. I mean, that's marketed. That's marketed for churches. And I could go on and on all night about talking about all of these other things rather than studying the Bible. I've heard of horror stories where that some member would go to a visitor. I'm really sorry that you were here today, because today the preacher was talking about homosexuality being a sin, and I'm sorry you had to hear that. There's some members that are very uncomfortable with sins being exposed. They don't want to hear a lesson against alcohol, a lesson against immodesty, a lesson against gambling,
A lesson against going to some of these bad movies. And they're uncomfortable when the preachers or the elders condemn these things. I think that's a symptom that we're too much of this world rather than of another world. Where do you feel the most comfortable? Here and now? Or do you think you're going to be comfortable when you get to heaven? If you don't enjoy being with your brethren here and now, how are you going to enjoy being with them for eternity? If you don't enjoy singing now, how are you going to enjoy singing throughout all eternity? Maybe we need to stop and figure out where our citizenship is. And figure out what's really the most important thing to us. If you're here this evening and you're not a Christian, we'd certainly like for you to become one. There are going to be days, it's going to be hard. There are going to be trials and there are going to be temptations. And there's going to be some times it's going to be difficult. I'm not going to promise you that. God never did promise you a bed of roses. He promised you a battleground. I mean, there was one occasion where a man said, "Jesus, I want to follow you." Now, Jesus wasn't trying to talk him out of it. But Jesus said, "Wait just a minute. Stop and count the cost." Jesus wants you to follow Him, but He's not trying to trick you. When Jim Jones took those people from Indiana and took them to the jungles of Ghana and gave them poisonous Kool-Aid and they all committed a massive suicide. When you look at down at Waco, Texas, when again so many of them die, a lot of these spiritual leaders try to trick you. Jesus wants you to know exactly what you're getting yourself into. Do you have what it takes? Can you say, "Jesus, I am ready to follow you. I surrender all." If you've never obeyed the gospel, we're going to encourage you to let it be known that you're ready to do that tonight. Or if you're here as a Christian and you've not been living like one, you've been of this world, would you like to start all over again? Let us know what's on your heart and how we can assist while together we stand and sing.